Composer Cliff Eidelman has carved out a path in the field of film music, concert music, ballet, choral music, among others, and he's joining us on Classical Conversations after having released a couple new recordings this year, including The Tempest and his Symphony No. 2, both of which he conducted in recordings by the Royal Scottish National Orchestra. Cliff, first of all, thank you for calling in from Santa Monica, and we're excited to loop you in with our audience here in Toledo.
Well, it's a pleasure. It's really a pleasure to be here with you.
In the realm of film, listeners may already know you from your scores for Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, Triumph of the Spirit, The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants. He's just not that into you. If I were to name just a few of them, could you brief us on your interest in your pursuit of film composition, maybe from the first time you thought, hey, this is something I think I'd like to do, to that moment you felt like you could really break through and immerse yourself in film?
Sure. I grew up in the LA area, and my parents always took us to movies. Movies, going to double feature was a common thing in my upbringing. So it was kind of early on something that I was always interested in. But my mom was a pianist, and she always played piano in the house, so I would hear, Beethoven sonatas or Mozart pieces, and she would mix that up with whatever, because she could basically play anything you ask her to play. She had a great ear and a great ability. So I was all around it all the time, both classical compositions and films. And so later on, growing up, I was always in bands. I played violin initially, and then I switched to guitar. So I kind of played in my own rock and progressive rock bands through the years, and playing clubs. I mean, we were only like 13 years old, and we were playing in local clubs, playing our original music. And then at some point, I started to get into more orchestral music and starting to listen to Stravinsky and Prokofiev and Rachmaninoff, and I started to kind of veer that in that direction. Just because the music was so satisfying to me. All of the there was a complexity and a kind of a compositional development that I wasn't getting from the band world for me, and I was yearning for that. And one day I went to a movie, and I think it's probably similar to a lot of composers. And I went to there was an area in our town called Westwood, which was where there's a lot of big movie theaters there back in the day, and Star Wars was playing, the original Star Wars. And I just remember sitting in the audience, and those opening chords just were blasting throughout the theater. And I just remember that was probably the first time I thought, wow, this is something I can do. It seemed viable to me. It seemed like something that I could make a living at in music composition. It seemed realistic. And I always loved writing music to stories. And so from there, the interest started. And some years later, I took a class at UCLA Extension. It was called, I think it was called like the Technique of Film Scoring. It was a good way to kind of get my feet wet in that world and see what the technique, what was involved in writing music to film and to writing music to time, as opposed to having all the time in the world, you're writing to scenes. So I took that and enjoyed that. And from there, it kind of, so that's how the interest began before ever really, before even going to college.
When you say that you write two scenes, are you working with like a screenplay or rough cuts? What does that look like?
Well, in the original class, they removed music from old Hawaii Five-O episodes, and we each student got an episode to write music to, and we each took a scene, and it was a way to sort of just practice and see what we can do with picture and story. I'll tell you, it was quite a dramatic first entry in, because when we went before a small orchestra to perform the pieces against our chosen scene, the French horns were not properly transcribed, transposed. You know how they're supposed to be transposed by a fifth, and they weren't done properly. And so the conductor, who was the teacher, got up and started conducting it, and all the French horns were a fifth off. So it wasn't the greatest. But aside from that, I did though think, wow, if the horns had been transcribed correctly, I did see that it was, for me, working, and it was exciting, you know, the whole thing. So even though it didn't pan out the way I thought, it still was a great entry into seeing what it's like. And I just love being in a room with musicians, you know, and playing the notes that I wrote down. There's nothing more fun for me than to hear great players sit down and start playing some of my ideas. And, you know, that's what gives a composer a thrill, really.
And I'm sure that was a lesson that you never forgot after that, having the experience.
I'll never forget that. Oh man, imagine four French horns. That's four lines, a fifth off. But the rest were okay. When you're writing music to film, every single film has its own color and story and emotional spine that's going on. That's kind of what's fun about film scoring. What I found through the years is that every single one is such a different experience that you're literally, you know, you're sitting down with initially possibly a script, if you're in early enough. And you start just dabbling around. For me, I would go on the piano and just start dabbling around with ideas. And if there was an early cut to the film before it was really finally edited, just early, what they would call dailies, or which are just rough scenes, or whatever the editing room could supply me, just so that I can start playing music against the picture, I would just start sitting down with it, trying out ideas, trying to imagine what it's going for. If it's an intimate type of film with lots of emotional storylines and characters that are interacting, and it's relationship based, I might go just visually more into a more intimate world and try to play the intimacies and the vulnerabilities. If it's something that's just swashbuckling and out and action-oriented, it's a completely different mindset coming in. So I would just play music against and see what starts hitting me. And after a while, after I go through a period of thinking that I've lost all my abilities and talent and whatever I thought I had, I've been fooling myself the whole time, because it takes me a little bit of time sometimes to finally hit on something. Once I get through that and have that first breakthrough and suddenly play it, and maybe the hair would stand up on the back of my neck, suddenly feel like, okay, I've arrived at something, then it's like, oh, I do have this talent. And all of a sudden I'm confident again. But I usually go through that insecure moment leading up to that. But ultimately, it's about just sitting down and playing things against picture. And once something strikes you, that begins to unravel all the other ideas that start following. And then you start to really have a clear understanding of where what music can really do to make this particular film more powerful, more interesting, more emotional. To me, the job is to heighten and to make it better. You know, that's how I always see a composer's job in film, is when you're done, you hope you've improved it, or you've raised it up to a different level. And sometimes actually the most powerful thing could be no music and keeping it very spare, and then sometimes coming in a very subtle way could sometimes be a lot more powerful than always playing music through everything. I think the best example of that, I remember Bernard Herrmann would pick and choose those moments to come in on those Hitchcock films and come in. And when he did come in, boy, he scared the hell out of the audience thoroughly because nobody expected it. He didn't get you prepared for those scary moments. And then so you were ready for it. Instead, he had this different idea. I think he was one of the first to see that you can pick and choose your spots to make it the most effective.
Now, when you do see your music starts to come together, you hear the dialogue with it, you hear the non-musical special effects with it. Are there times that you have to really revise it to make sure that the music isn't overpowering or that it's complementing some of the other sound effects?
It's a process until it's done. And I find that you're always looking at all of the elements that are coming into a particular area. The sound effects supervisor or editor or person that's involved in getting all the sound effects together, they have their own spotting sessions where they literally spot with the production or the director all the sound that they're going to be bringing to a scene. A good example of that is in Star Trek VI, there was an ice planet scene where it was on a kind of a frozen prison planet where the worst of the worst would be imprisoned in this underground cave. But on the surface was this freezing, windy, stormy, snowy thing going on. And I just knew there was going to be a lot of wind, there was going to be a lot of sound going on. And meanwhile, I was writing something very percussive against that. So I kind of wasn't competing with explosions or things of that nature. So I knew that this percussive idea was kind of going to be in its own space, while all this kind of smooth, loud wind and everything was just kind of going to be breezing around it, but with the hopes that there would be this separation between them. So they're not competing for the same things. There is a certain amount of that kind of looking to see what would be the best thing to write and the most effective thing to write. There are unavoidable moments where a battle scene is going on and there's explosions going everywhere and rockets are flying and so forth. Meanwhile, I'm sitting there writing this action piece and I know they're going to be colliding left and right. Well, I try to sort of avoid some of the obvious explosions because whatever I write there is just going to be obliterated and will not be heard and won't be adding to anything. So there's a certain amount of that goes on. Ultimately, you end up in this dubbing room with the director and mixers, and they're mixing all of this together. You're hoping that your music won't get completely buried, but sometimes it does. And if that's the vision of the director, well, that's what's going to happen. As a composer, you're always yelling, louder for the music. But I had a different technique for it, which is to just point out to the director what's in the score and who's playing in that moment. And I would say to the director, would you like to preview that? Just so you know what's there. And then you could decide if you want the sound effects to be exactly where they are, or if you want to adjust them so that you can hear that, So I would do it that way. That way the director takes charge of it. And very often they'll say, yeah, let me hear what's there. I don't recall exactly what you did there. And they'll listen to it and say, in the best case scenario, say, hey, can you lower that particular explosion so that brass chord is still existing? Because it works better that way. Or the director might just say, no, I like it the way it is. Let's continue. And that's that. But at least you got to say, did you want to preview it? That's how I always handled it, let the director decide, but suggest checking it out.
Well, I appreciate you giving us some of the behind the scenes on your film composition. I imagine there are probably a lot of composers who would be interested in being in your shoes. What kind of advice might you have for composers who are looking into that field and wanting to build something in that realm?
Well, for one, I would say you should love to tell stories in music. You should love programmatic storytelling. You should probably don't go into it unless you love the art form. I would also say you have to have a lot of patience can't have too big of an ego, even though we all have an ego, but about what we've written. But ultimately, it's the director's medium. So I would say always have the attitude that the job is not over until it's fully over, and to just kind of roll with the punches if they come in. You know, if somebody wants a change of music, or if you're asked to rewrite things, my best advice would be to just see it as a process rather than a I've already done it. You don't want to come in and go, I've already done it. You know, you want to just see it as a, oh, okay, let me try something else. You have to kind of have that mindset of it's not done until it's done. And done, when I mean it's done, it means that the film has been mixed, the dubbing session is over, and release date is on its way, and so forth. That's what done is. Until that happens, you're still working on it.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you say it's not over till it's over. And thinking with that in mind, what is it like for you when it is over and you get to watch it back?
I love it. I mean, for me, I used to enjoy, and I would still enjoy this, is to go to a movie theater. Let's say it's being released theatrically. I used to like going to the theater on a just a regular weeknight and kind of just sit in with the audience and see if they're laughing in the right places, or if they seem to be responding in the right places, and just to see if all the plans that we had were working, you know. And it was just a chance to see what was working and what may it not have been working. I love that. That was probably the most exciting thing for me. Was the third film score that I ever did was a film called Dead Man Out for HBO. It was the early days of HBO doing features, very early days, but they were doing superb features. This one was starring Ruben Blades and Danny Glover, directed by Richard Pierce, and they delivered this powerful film about an inmate on death row. And I wrote this very serious score. It was only about 25 minutes of total score for the 90-minute film. So there was a lot of silences throughout. But it was exciting for me because it was the first time I remember they were airing it. And I went up into went into to my bedroom and turned on the television and tuned in. And I was watching it, and I thought all of a sudden, wow, this is, and all of a sudden I hear my music playing over the television. And I thought, my God, and it's being broadcast nationally. You know, that was the first time I'd ever realized that a lot of people were experiencing this right now, and that I had something to do with it. And I could actually hear the music playing. So that was an exciting first. And of course, going to a cinema is even more exciting than that, because then now you're hearing everything on big speakers, and you're with a group of people. You're not sitting alone in a room watching something get streamed. Or yeah, when you're with a crowd of people, you feel that live feeling going on.
I do want to chat a little bit about your concert works as well. And maybe a good point of departure here is how do you feel like composing concert works is similar to or different than your work in film?
Well, I kind of see concert music as more like, I never really understood what the word concert music or serious music meant. It never meant anything to me. But there was this friend of mine, his name is Richard Guerin, who said to me recently, he said, well, I see it as personal music. And that meant something to me. Then I thought a light bulb went off and said, that's really what it is. You're writing more personal music. You're writing music that isn't necessarily something that's a collaborative effort. It's something where the music is standing on its own for its own sake. And the star of the show is the music. You know, it's not the actors on the screen. It's entirely the music. For me, concert music or personal music, it was a chance to kind of take control of that for myself. And it was a good contrast. I always did it concurrently with film music. Like whenever I was on a break from film music, I would do a concert piece. But for me, it was kind of a way to kind of have that time to just write music for music itself. And it almost refreshed me for wanting to go back and to do another film score, because it gave me time away from it to be able to do what I wanted to do in that field. But it's also, you know, it's a chance to develop ideas more extensively. Like in the case of my Second Symphony, There are four movements, and each movement is elaborated and developed the way that I wanted to develop it. And it didn't end when a scene ended. It ended when the music thought it needed to end. I kind of see it like, in a way, film music to me is a little more like theme and variations, and writing a symphony is more like writing a novel. I don't see one greater than the other. Honestly, I see music as music. Whether it's opera, ballet, film, personal concert music, whatever it is, I just see music as a music. And if you're a composer, you're just writing music. And the most important thing to me is that I don't become a different composer when I'm doing one thing and then another. I don't become like I don't write film music and then when I write concert music, completely disband everything that I am as a film composer. And suddenly you're like, who is that person? It suddenly sounds so different. I'm not that. I think if you know my film music and you hear a concert piece, you'll write. Hopefully, that's what I've been told is that I can only tell you what I've been told, that it's easily, you could easily recognize that it's me writing it.
Oh, that's especially interesting because I know The Tempest is, even though it's a new recording, this is a piece that you had written earlier and there was some time in between. So when you revisited it, did you revise the score itself or were you mostly revising the way you conducted it? I'm just curious how to to look back on who you were then and who you are now.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of like I was, I feel like I was a kid back then, when I, what, but I, that's how I feel. I wasn't a kid, I was an adult, but I felt like that looking back now. And it, I did not revise the score at all. I was always perfectly happy with the score. But having time to just think about it over the years, and I always thought, if I were to record this again, I might elaborate a little longer into this section or take this section a little slower or expand the broadness of this section over here. Ultimately, that's what I did. I kind of reinterpreted it a little bit and kind of came to it with kind of a fresh look. And I still honestly like the original recording. It's just that I wanted to express it a little bit differently, like particularly the third movement, which, originally, I should say this, the whole piece was conceived as a tone poem. The definition of a tone poem is that it's typically one movement. It's like one long piece that kind of gives you an impression of the whole story. So this time, it was always in three sections. And I decided to put the three sections into three movements. One is the storm, one is the island when they land on the island, and one is called love, the final movement. And I broke it up into three. It still feels like a tone poem. It's just that there's three breaks in it. So the definition doesn't perfectly apply anymore, but I still see it that way as a tone poem. It's just broken into three. I did do that in this version, and I also gave titles to the three sections and reinterpreted it. It was great getting in front of the same orchestra that I was with all those years ago. I don't know, 25 years before, and I brought the same parts with me to the session, and the parts were put out on the stands, and I heard a few players stand there and they looked and they said, "Hey, those are my pencil markings." They recognized their own pencil markings from 25 years ago, because there was still probably half the orchestra that's still there from back then. And so some of these players were playing it for a second recording, and that was really, I have to say, that was fun to know that some of these players were the original players, and that gave me a lot of joy.
What would you say are some of your current or upcoming projects that we can look forward to?
Well, the current project is my next actual release is this very great pianist in Italy named Simone Pedrone, recorded a set of some piano works of mine. One was called The Five Tales, which Michael McHale from the UK performed in 2019, and it was recorded. So Simone did his own interpretation of it, along with a piece that I did called Bridges, which is another solo piano piece. And so he did the Five Tales and Bridges and put it on one album. I hope people have a chance to check that out. He completely reinterpreted this music in a way that I could have never imagined. I mean, it's so different. It goes to show you, in the hands of a great artist, pianist, they come to it and look at it different. They just come to it with their own vision. And I had my own vision, which was very different in tempos and in the way you pull and tug the piece and so forth. The notes are all the same, but I have to say, I listened to it and I thought, wow, I can't believe what a cool idea that is. You know, I never thought that would work. And so I'm excited to see that. And of course, The Tempest is just newly released and available on all streaming platforms. And now I'm just toying with some new ideas. You know, I'm always looking to try new things out and see if I can expand my repertoire a bit. So always a work in progress here.
I've been speaking with composer Cliff Eidelman on his life and works and upcoming projects. And Cliff, thank you for spending this time with us today.
Oh, thank you so much. It was great, great talking with you. Really great.